Please be seated. Well, this morning we are blessed with students who have come to visit the court. We had students here the last argument, and we are going to have them here again for this argument. And my notes tell me it's Bigfoot High School. If you all are here, will you stand, please? Oh, wonderful. Great group. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with court with class, and as part of that joint effort with the State Bar of Wisconsin, we do have a justice that will come and speak with you all at the conclusion of this argument. You may be joined by other students who were here for the first argument. Today, that justice will be Justice Annette Ziegler, so if you wait around, she'll be here to speak with you. I'd like to introduce the rest of the court to you as well. To Justice Ziegler's right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And at the far end of the bench, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those brief remarks, we will begin with our second case for the morning. Are you ready to begin? It looks as though you are.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, please do.
May it please the court. My name is Dennis Malowski, and I am the attorney representing Adam Blackman. There must be a limit to the consequences to which motorists may be deemed to have consented by virtue of a decision to drive on public roads. That is a direct quote from the majority decision in Birchfield versus North Dakota. Your Honors, Section 343.305(3)(AR)(2) of the Wisconsin statutes is the limit that the Birchfield Court warned about.
Well, they warned about criminal penalties, Counselor, but they also said nothing in their decision should be read to cast aspersions on implied consent laws. How do you line that up with the statement you just made?
Well, which portion of the implied consent law, Your Honor?
Well, I leave that to your argument.
For those individuals who have been lawfully arrested for operating while intoxicated or operating with a restricted controlled substance, the implied consent law is not constitutionally invalid. However, Wisconsin's implied consent law goes much farther and applies to those who have not even been suspected of operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated, much less even having consumed intoxicants. And that is precisely the situation that we have with Mr. Blackman. Mr. Blackman was involved in an injury accident at 10:10 on a Saturday morning. Police officers were summoned to the scene. Police officers spoke at length with Mr. Blackman. He was cooperative. They questioned him extensively. At no time did any law enforcement officer smell alcohol, suspect alcohol, observe drugs, believe that he was impaired in even the most minimal way. In fact, the officer conceded, and I cross-examined the officer in this case, the officer conceded at the hearing that there was no evidence of even consumption of alcohol. Nevertheless, Mr. Blackman was detained, and make no uncertain mistake about that, ladies and gentlemen, he was detained by the officer's own admission. Pursuant to their department policy to, quote, take blood in these cases.
Well, the statute allows the department to do that, correct?
No. The statute does not allow the officer to take blood. Nothing in the implied consent law would allow an officer to take blood based on no suspicion that they're going to find what they're looking for in the blood. The officer, presumably acting under the auspices of this statute, although importantly, he never said that. He said he was acting under his department's policy to, quote, take blood in these cases.
Well, presumably the police department's policy is to follow the law, yes?
One might presume that, but it's okay. Nowhere in the record.
Well, let's presume that for a moment and figure that our good fellow citizens in blue have the intent of following the law. 305 AR sub 1 and well, sub 2 provides that they can require a blood test in an accident causing great bodily harm or death. Yes.
That's what the statute allows, and that's precisely what makes it unconstitutional, Your Honor, because it rife through our constitutional history involving impaired driving cases dating back to Schmerber versus California. It has always been incumbent that there be a, quote, clear indication that the cops are going to find what they're looking for in the blood. Doesn't that at least require...
But we've dispensed with that by statute. We say that you get in a car, you consent to a blood draw. Well, that releases all manner of Fourth Amendment protections, that consent, right?
I disagree, Your Honor. And I'll take you back, and actually, I'm hoping this will definitively answer the questions that were asked in the last argument.
All right.
Because repeatedly, I heard the court...
Before you do
yes.
that, let me just set this up for you so that I can understand your answer. So if a person gives consent, then they move themselves out of the Fourth Amendment realm, right? A consensual search is not forbidden by the Fourth Amendment. Right?
Are we talking about implied consent?
Let's take the qualifier off for just a moment to set up the question. A consensual search does not fall within the Fourth Amendment, correct?
If the consent, viewed under a totality of the circumstances, was freely and voluntarily given,
right.
Then yes.
So, for example, an officer could walk up to someone on the street and having never met them before or observed their activity or anything, could say, would you give me a sample of your blood? The person could say yes, right?
Well, there's no doubt, and this is analogous, Judge, to, if you remember the U.S. Supreme Court of Florida versus Bostick, which is a guy in a bus stop carrying a suitcase or a satchel. Cop walks up to him and says, I want to search, or can I search the bag?
Right.
And the analysis that the court used in that case was, would a reasonable person, under the totality of the circumstances, believe they could say no to the officer's encounter and walk away, ending the encounter? The
right.
difference between a true consensual encounter and an encounter such as the one we're dealing with here is that the person who the officer just walks up to isn't read a form that says, if you refuse, your license will be revoked.
Right, which is true.
No, it's not true. Not for black men. Not for black
right.
men or
so
people in black men's situation.
Yeah, let's slow down the argument just a little bit so that we can make sure we don't trip over any important points. So let's go back to the consent, right? So a person can consent to a search, and if it's freely and voluntarily given, search can be done. The Fourth Amendment has nothing to say about that, correct?
If it is unconstrained, uncoerced consent
right.
under the totality of the circumstances.
Okay. So now, here what we have is our implied consent statute, and we've decided for Mr. Blackman that he has given consent, and we've told him, you have given your consent freely and voluntarily, and you did that by getting in your car.
Well, and that's why I wanted to start this, because I think this quote from Birchfield is going to dispense with any further questions about this. Because Birchfield, again, quoting from the majority opinion, consent cannot be determined by the presence in an implied consent law alone. Rather, one must always consider the totality of the circumstances when determining whether consent was voluntarily given. So to answer the questions that were put in the last argument and to answer the question that I'm likely going to get, if the argument, like the state wants you to buy into, rife in their brief, is It's the implied consent law. He's already consented. End of story. Not end of story. The implied consent law alone can never provide the basis for a search.
Look, let us assume, not everybody on the court or everybody or all the counsel here will accept. Let us assume that there is consent under the statute, but that the statute allows recanting of consent, refusal to give consent, opportunity to refuse, right to refuse, whatever you want to say. Your client consented. They said to him, you want to take a blood test, and we have a right to take a blood test, and your client, and they read him the form, right?
Yes, they did.
And your client said, okay, right?
He did use those words.
Okay. So we have consent.
No, we don't.
Just a minute. As I understand your argument, you don't have consent because you're saying he was misinformed, therefore the consent was no good under the totality of the circumstances test.
Well, that is part of my argument.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about that part and then tell me what your other part is. Okay. So how was he misinformed?
He was misinformed because the informing the accused form told him that if he refused to submit to the officer's test, his license would be revoked in addition to other penalties.
Okay.
That is not true for someone in Blackman's situation. It is true for those who have been lawfully arrested for operating while intoxicated. Those drivers are facing revocation and other penalties.
And what did he face?
He was facing arrest, and the statute is clear on that. The statute, and this is why, you know, I know Mr. Sanders got bogged down in a lot of legislative history in his brief. I don't think we ever get there, but I've got a smoking gun legislative history that I'll get to in a second if we really need to go that far.
Just stay with the statute.
Okay.
The statute says it applies to your client.
It does not.
What about revocation? Is he going to be revoked?
No, because the statute, AR2, says a person who refuses an AR2 test, which was Blackman, may be arrested under paragraph 3A, which talks about people who have been lawfully arrested for drunk driving. So the statute is clear that people, drivers in Mr. Blackman's situation, are not facing license revocation. They are facing arrest under 3A.
Was his license suspended for any time?
His license was administratively suspended due to his BAC result.
So telling him that it was going to be revoked, rather than telling him it would be administratively suspended, do you think is misinformation?
No, because it says, the form says, if you refuse the test, your license will be revoked. Had he refused the test, he was not under any circumstance facing a license revocation for anything. The way the statute is supposed to work, if a person is involved in an injury accident and there's no basis to believe anything related to impairment, and those people are asked to submit to a test and refuse, AR2 plainly says they may be arrested under paragraph 3A, which talks about an arrest for drunk driving, which is really the problem with this statute. This statute, if it works the way it's supposed to work, if it works the way it's written, allows a person to be arrested for drunk driving based on a simple refusal of a chemical test where there's no underlying suspicion of anything. So the statute is unconstitutional on its face because it goes too far. I mean, consider this, Judge, and we have a drawer full of clients who fall into this category. You're leaving. You're pulling out of the garage here onto Capitol Square. You make a right-hand turn, and you hit a pedestrian, and the pedestrian breaks their arm. And, oh, by the way, you have a broken taillight or an expired plate, or perhaps you didn't come to a complete stop. Under this statute, even though there's no suspicion of drug use, alcohol consumption, anything, the officer in that situation has the ability to detain you, take you to the hospital, and ask that you submit to a test.
When you say detain, has he arrested me?
Well, he's certainly detained. He's certainly detained, and the officer at the hearing made that very clear, that he was not free to go.
And that's an arrest.
I don't disagree with you. But you will be taken to the hospital, and they will draw your blood if you say yes. And they'll search for anything. If you took Benadryl that morning, or if you took your Claritin, or if you took some prescription medication that might cause drowsiness, and they find it in your blood, you will be prosecuted. And I have a drawer full of clients who fall into that category. The sweep and reach of this statute is simply too far.
How do we know it's too far?
It's too far because, Your Honor, it eliminates any particularized suspicion for the crime or offense for which they are searching your blood. They're searching your blood for drug or alcohol. Doesn't the Constitution require at a minimum that they have some indication, an odor, an observation of some impairment, an admission by the person that they've been drinking?
Yes, absent consent, you would need that. But what we have here is a statute that ascribes consent to Mr. Blackman. Under these circumstances, he's agreed that he will submit to a blood test.
But if you're basing on his consent, on the implied consent law alone, mm-hmm. then you're flying in the face of Birchfield.
And how so?
Well, because the Birchfield court, this is a quote from Birchfield, from Justice Alito, the majority opinion author. Consent cannot be determined by the presence in an implied consent law alone.
What's your site of the page? I'm reading Birchfield as we're sitting here. I'm not finding it. I'm not doubting that what you're telling me is true, but I'd like to know what page.
While you're finding that, can I just ask you a preliminary question? Where's the evidence in the record that there was the officer's belief this person was operating while under the influence? Where was the indicia of intoxication?
He never suspected it.
So how does the officer get under 2R to begin with, and how would this ever survive the very first issue that comes up in a refusal hearing?
Exactly. And that's exactly why the trial court judge, who, by the way, I have to say, with respect to Judge Sharp, Padley got it wrong. Blackman Court of Appeals got it wrong. The only person who's ever looked at this issue, and I've raised it more than once, who ever understood how this works to its logical extent was Judge Sharp. And he spelled it out very clearly. There was no suspicion of anything, Your Honor. There wasn't an admission to drinking. There wasn't an odor of alcohol. There wasn't an open intoxicant. It happened at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday when it would be atypical for this type of situation to happen. It happened in a rural area, not near bars. All of the things that we would normally look to support a basis of suspicion is entirely absent. There is literally nothing in this case other than an injury accident and their belief that he failed to yield the right of way to the bicycle. So those two facts alone, under this statute, allow the officer to detain the person, take them to the hospital, read them a form that is plainly wrong.
No, the statute requires that indicia of intoxication.
It doesn't require. Not under this section.
2R?
343-305-AR2. And it used to be, Your Honors, it's telling to look at this statute in its original form, because this statute first came about in 2005.
Is this your smoking gun?
I'm getting there.
Okay. Right, but doesn't it require the officer to have reason to believe the person violated the law? Oh, I see what you're saying.
Just the traffic statute.
Provision.
And
they
then the next provision.
They just have to have an...
When was that enacted, counsel?
This law, in its original form,
but
was enacted in 2005 WSAC 463.
Amendment that put in this language that you're talking about.
Well, I want to talk about the – I need to talk about the original statute first,
okay.
Your Honor, because they eliminated a sentence that made this unconstitutional.
But if you have a refusal hearing, the very first issue is what I just discussed. Mm-hmm. So that's what's holding me up.
Correct.
How do you ever get to that hearing without the officer having had the indicia of intoxication?
That's exactly right. And that's why the threatened license revocation in the informing the accused form was completely illusory and not applicable to Mr. Blackmon. He would have prevailed at any refusal hearing before any judge, even the most unreasonable one in the state. He would have prevailed at a refusal hearing.
We've eliminated those. They're not hearing.
So getting back to the point that I was trying to make with 2005 WSAC 463, the way this law originally was incarnated, it required the officer, and I have the direct quote here, if the officer detected any presence of alcohol, if there was a traffic violation and an injury, if the officer detected any presence of alcohol, they could do this type of testing that was done here. 2009, when this act was amended, they eliminated that sentence. So the earlier version, while I don't want to say it was constitutional, was certainly far better because at least it required some bare bones indication that there might be alcohol or drugs involved. But this statute, the way it exists now, and the way it was applied to Mr. Blackmon, there was no requirement. Accident plus injury plus any traffic violation. There's not even a requirement that the traffic violation be related to the accident. So literally any person who's involved in an injury accident, who has a expired plate, who has a broken taillight, a headlight out, any manner of ridiculous equipment violations, they would fall under this statute. Its reach is incredible. And it's real world, because we're not talking about hypotheticals here. I represent old women who are on...
Careful there.
You are now on thin ice.
I think your time is up for me.
I am very sorry.
Well, you could say you can refer to anybody on the bench.
That's right. You represent the old men. Right.
Yeah. Well, actually, honestly, Your Honor, when it comes to prescription medication cases, I can't think of a man that I've represented. It's been exclusively women.
They
so
only
I meant
drink.
I meant no disrespect. But all they have to do is find something, and they test for everything these days. It's not just that they're looking for alcohol. And this was Birchfield's big problem with blood tests and why they said blood tests are treated differently. Is because when you submit a sample of your blood, it's theirs now. They keep it. They can test for disease. They can test for DNA. They can test for prescription drugs. They can test for supplements that you might take that might cause you to be drowsy and therefore charged with an OWI under this statute. And this is the bridge too far, or as Mr. Perlman more succinctly said, the implied consent law is not a blank check. The implied consent law, while it is fine for those who are lawfully arrested, where cops have probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion, I got no beef with it. But for this class of drivers who fall under this, frankly, absurd statute that allows a fishing expedition just to see if there is something there, it shouldn't be tolerated. So the statute constitutionally is problematic, but if you want to look at the consent issue.
Counsel, how would you interpret the statute as being unconstitutional based on the ingestion of drugs? There are many illicit drugs that are causing us tons of problems in our state with people using them. People drive when they've been smoking marijuana. There was a recent report in the newspaper this last week of a woman driving who'd taken heroin shortly before she got in the car. How is the officer going to know that any of those things are
in play, well, isn't this section of the statute designed to cover drugs that don't overtly express themselves to someone who happens to be watching the driver?
The legislature's interest is in keeping impaired drivers off the road.
Okay, I agree.
People who are smoking marijuana, taking heroin, huffing, whatever the case may be, those people are going to exhibit signs of impairment. If not signs of impairment, at least signs of use. Maybe their tongue is green, like we see officers talk about. The person who smokes marijuana has a green tongue. Maybe they see a roach clip in the cup holder. Maybe there is an odor of alcohol, but no overt signs of impairment. There has to be something, Your Honor, that piques the officer's suspicion.
Making a turn making a turn involved in the use of the highway in a way that doesn't recognize there's someone close by, as there was here, that your actions could impact, could be a sign of impairment. I mean, I don't know. I personally have no knowledge of what you look like if you're doing a drug, do you're doing marijuana, do you're doing some other kind of cocaine or heroin. I just don't know what those things would be. But I'm not altogether persuaded that officers can see that from someone they stop after an accident or who stops, as this person did, because of the accident.
Your Honor, these officers are highly trained. Well, they look for things that you in a million years wouldn't dream of.
I agree with that.
The size of the pupils, the color of the tongue, the nervous fidgeting, the presence of items in the vehicle that might suggest that there's drugs there.
Blurry eyes, that's the big one.
And none of those things...
Glassy eyes.
Correct. Glassy eyes, bloodshot eyes. Someone who is on drugs, Your Honor, is going to exhibit, in the 99% of the cases, some evidence of that. Now, if you want to talk about the accident and, well, he failed to yield, you know, failed to yield to the bicyclist, and that could be a sign of impairment, this is where the actual numbers become important, because this statute essentially treats all drivers as drunk drivers by default. If you look at the most recent statistics that the Department of Transportation has in 2014, and we cited these numbers in our brief.
Well, counsel, before you go too far down that road, this argument depends on the implied consent not being a sufficient basis on which to take the blood sample. And you mentioned you might find something in Birchfield. I don't know if you've been able to, your associate has been able to find that, but that might be good to know either right now or when you come back up for your reply.
Well, and Your Honor, the Padley Court also reaffirms that basis as well, that the implied consent law was never intended to end the inquiry as to voluntariness of consent. Thank you.
Well, counsel, let me just say, when you come back up, you've made a constitutional argument, but you also have a statutory argument, counsel, and I want you to tell me why the court should do a constitutional argument rather than a statutory one on consent. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Sanders. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the state of Wisconsin.
So anyone involved in an accident, if a ticket could be given for anything, can have their blood taken?
If there is a crash involving death or great bodily harm, and the officer has knows that the person violated a traffic law, yes. Then the officer can request that the person submit a blood sample.
Does the violation of the traffic law have to do with that specific accident?
Under the language of the statute, if it says if the officer has reason to believe that the person violated any state or local traffic law. So I would say no. Under the plain language. To clear up how the statute works, I don't think what we heard was right. The arrest that happens after the officer requests a sample under 3AR is not for a drunk driving. It could be in some cases, but it can also be for the refusal. And I think that's clear from the plain language of sub 3A.
Okay, but we might bump up against each other a little bit on the refusal, because how do you get past the very first thing that a judge considers in a refusal?
At the refusal hearing?
Yeah.
Well, that won't come into play until the end. At the time that the officer asks, though, will you take a test, all the officer has to have under the statute is that there was a crash and someone either died or has grave bodily harm, and the officer knows that, and the officer has reason to believe that the person broke a traffic law.
I understand the statute, but the way you deal with the penalty for the refusal in that statute is to have a refusal hearing, or is there something else that I've missed?
Well, if the person refuses, and if I may just kind of get to how it works, if the officer requests a sample under 3AR,
right,
and if the person says yes, then it's
fine.
We're
not there. So
if the person says no, then the officer can arrest the person under sub 3A.
What are they arresting for?
It could be for a drunk driving or that type of offense, but it could also be for refusal.
Well, assuming you have no indicia of intoxication, you just have an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So what are they arresting for?
In that case, the officer would arrest the person for refusal.
But aren't
and I think that's clear under sub 3A.
Aren't we in Fourth Amendment territory there? And so the person is essentially being arrested for exercising their constitutional right.
Well, you don't have a constitutional right to refuse.
But at that point, and I think I'm drawing on, if I understand Mr. Perlman's argument, I know you were here for it, we're in Fourth Amendment territory. We're under McNeely at that point, so the officer has to get a warrant. But you're telling me that if the individual who is stopped, involved in this accident, if they refuse the blood test, that at that point the officer has to get a warrant for, then aren't they being punished by being arrested for exercising a constitutional right?
Well, you don't need the there isn't a need at that point. It's a strange law. It is a two-part process. The way it works is the officer asks for a test under sub 3AR. If the person says yes, fine. If the person says no, at that point the officer cannot issue a notice of intent to revoke. All the officer can do at that point is arrest under sub 3A. The arrest can be for refusal, and then that gets you to the point where you then read the form again and ask the person, will you take a test? If the person says no that time, then you get to the notice of intent to revoke.
Okay, but I'm going to pump the brakes on you there for a minute. You've got to go back. I refuse, so what's my remedy? I can have a refusal hearing.
If you refuse twice under this part of the statute, if you refuse the first time under sub 3AR,
that's what I'm talking
about. Then the officer cannot mark that as a refusal and cannot issue a notice of intent. All the officer can do under the plain language of sub 3AR is arrest under sub 3A. And then it becomes a 3A case.
But assuming you have no indicia of intoxication, mm-hmm, what's the arrest for?
If there's nothing else, it could be for whichever law you broke. So in this case, failure to yield. Or it can be for refusal.
Counsel?
And then at that point, you get to 3A, and you then are read the form again and asked if you want to take a test. And if you say no that time, that is the refusal that is a 3A refusal, and then you get the notice of intent to revoke and the right to a refusal hearing.
All right. So
but if the person says no and then says yes, it's not a refusal.
All right. Yeah. Well, counsel, that's
I didn't write the statute.
All right. So let's walk down that path then.
Okay.
So so if he says no both times, there is issued a notice of intent to revoke, but that's not a revocation, correct?
It is going to be one unless the person requests a hearing in within 10 days and then at the hearing wins.
Yes, okay. So, but at that point, you issue the notice of intent to revoke.
Yes.
That's not a revocation.
That is the same under the whole law, yes. Right. It's
okay.
Not
so revocation,
only under 3AR.
Yeah, revocation only happens if the defendant does not request a hearing or the state prevails at the hearing.
Yes.
All right. And if the defendant asks for a hearing, then the state in this case, there's no possibility of prevailing.
It is highly unlikely.
It's not only highly unlikely. The officer in this case testified there was absolutely no indicia of cause to believe this person was operating while intoxicated.
Well, I should say that we don't know what exactly may have occurred in this case had the defendant said no. Then the officer may have had enough to do field tests or may have had enough to do a PBT
yeah.
or
yeah.
may have had enough to get more
perhaps.
So that there may have been
yeah, perhaps
that.
So.
But in this case, he said yes.
Right. So, but the question is, I understand Mr. Blackman to be asking is, was I properly informed of the consequences of my refusal? And he says no, because the informing the consent form says that I will be revoked. And given the circumstances as we know they exist, and who knows what would have happened if he had said no, all we have are the facts before us. And the facts before us indicate there's no possibility the state could have revoked. In fact, as the officer stood there reading that form to him, telling him that he would be revoked if he said no, the officer had no basis to believe he could get a revocation.
I don't know that that's true. I don't know what the officer thought about what may or may not have happened had the defendant said no and then requested a refusal hearing within 10 days.
I'm talking about at the moment he was reading the form to the accused. Right? As you said, we do know that when he testified, he said, I had no basis for believing that he was operating while intoxicated, no basis at all. So as he was reading that form to Mr. Blackman, there was nothing in his mind to suggest that he would actually be able to get a revocation of the license.
I don't know that that's true because I don't know what may have happened had the defendant. I don't think there's any other way to answer that.
No, there is. I'm talking about the question is the accuracy of the information he was giving Mr. Blackman at the time he was giving the information.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, regardless of what might have happened later, at that time, he had no information to suggest that Mr. Blackman was operating while intoxicated, correct?
I think that's true, yes.
Okay.
I'll state it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
All of us, including police officers, are held to know the law, right? So here you've got an experienced police officer. He's held to know the law on drunk driving. Therefore, he would know that since there was no suspicion of drunk driving, that the defendant here would win on a hearing.
Had he known that the law, that sub 9 of the law, which I don't know why the officer would know what sub 9 said.
Well,
because
why wouldn't he? Everybody knows the law. That's our fiction. We hold that the defendant knows the law. Why do we hold that the police officer and the judge and everyone else knows the law?
His job at the time was to do what the form said. It's to do what the law said. And it says, under this exact circumstance, you read the form, you ask him for a test. If he says no, you arrest him, you read the form again, you ask for a test again. If he says no, you issue a notice of intent to revoke. And that's exactly what the officer, I expect, would have done had the defendant said no.
Are you arguing good faith at all?
Yes.
Counsel?
He did exactly what sub 4 says. And if there is a problem, it's in sub 9. And that comes well after. That isn't anything that he has to tell the person until he gives him the notice of intent, which is after he has refused twice.
As you went through the progress, you said, and then he would arrest him.
Mm-hmm.
And the circuit court here said, the question of the century is arrested for what?
Yes.
The circuit court went on to say that had Blackman refused the test, the officer could have only arrested him for impaired driving. But you...
I don't agree.
Right.
Sorry.
You have said in your argument that he could be arrested for the refusal. Now, in the prior argument, we heard this developed argument, and as it developed, it went from opportunity to refuse to right to refuse. So are you saying that he could be arrested for exercising his right to refuse?
There is no right to refuse under Wisconsin law. As this court said in Rader in 1999, there is no right to withdraw.
Is there a statutory opportunity here?
I can quote it if you'd like. Yes.
There's a statutory opportunity.
Yes. There is no statutory right. There is no constitutional right. It is a statutory opportunity.
And if it would be viewed as a statutory right to refuse or a constitutional right to refuse, then he couldn't be arrested for exercising that right, if that premise were accepted.
I expect that's true.
Counsel, can you tell me what the difference is between a statutory opportunity and a statutory right?
I can tell you what this court said in that case. The right of refusal, if granted by the legislature, is a statutory privilege, not a constitutional right. Unlike similar laws in other states, the Wisconsin Implied Consent Statute, WISDAT 343-305, creates no such statutory privilege.
So,
it's saying you don't have a privilege to do it because if you do it, you are going to pay for it.
Well, you're
going to lose your license.
That's a separate question, aside from whether you have the right to do it, and then the question is whether you can impose penalties on exercising a right. But even at the beginning of your quote, you referenced it as being a statutory right to refuse.
No.
Read that again.
The right of refusal, if granted by the legislature, is a statutory privilege. Unlike laws in other states, the Wisconsin statute creates no such statutory privilege. So it says we don't have that. We do not have a statutory right.
But
if we did, we would have one, but we don't.
Do we have a privilege?
No.
This
court said no in a unanimous case in 1999, and I don't see anything that says it's wrong.
Can you give me the exact site that you read from?
Yes. It's 227 Wis. 2nd 213. At 239.
Thank you very much.
All right. So now
the unanimous 1999 case.
We heard in the prior case that from petitioner's counsel that once consent has been given, it can be revoked, and that is a constitutional right to revoke consent previously given. Is that not true here?
You gave consent when you started the car and you drove on a Wisconsin highway.
Right.
You have an opportunity to withdraw consent.
Okay.
In this case, you have two opportunities to withdraw consent.
But is it true? Let's just start with a baseline constitutional principle. Is it true that if you give consent for the government to take an action, that you can then revoke that consent, and that is a constitutional right to withdraw that consent?
Yes, but that is the consent you gave when you pulled the car out onto a Wisconsin highway,
so that's,
and you can stop driving.
Okay. You could also, once you stop driving, because he did, and when he had the accident, he stopped driving, right? He wasn't driving anymore.
Right.
All right. So now... at that point, can he withdraw his consent?
No.
Why not?
because
if there is a constitutional right to withdraw consent previously given, what about the driving context changes that?
At that point, he is in the implied consent land, and he can't withdraw consent. He doesn't have a right to withdraw it. When the officer asks him, will you take a test, he can certainly say no.
Okay, so
and they aren't going to force it.
Yeah, so help me understand this. So actual consent can be withdrawn, but implied consent cannot.
I don't think there's any difference between those two things. That's what the court talked about in one case, but I don't think this court has ever talked about it.
So help me understand.
It's just consent.
I'm obviously missing a very important step here, and I don't know where it is. So we agree that consent, once given, can be withdrawn. We have, in this case, in these kinds of circumstances, we have implied consent that you give when you get in your car.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's consent given. So can that not be withdrawn?
You can withdraw it because when the officer asks you, will you now take a test like you said you would do, you can say no.
Okay. So that is
And that is withdrawing consent.
All right. So that is the exercise of a constitutional right to withdraw your consent.
It is not, because there is no statutory right to withdraw the implied consent you give under the implied consent law, and that's what this court said in 1999, and every other case that this court's ever had has said the same thing.
I'm not talking about statutory right to withdraw.
Right.
I'm talking about constitutional right. And as I recall, the Constitution trumps the statutes. So if there is a constitutional right to withdraw consent once given, the statutes can't change that.
As this court said, there is no constitutional right to withdraw consent under the implied consent law.
Right. Okay. So now where does the death of the constitutional right to withdraw consent come from?
Where does
the death of the right to withdraw consent, where does that come from? Is it statutory basis? Is there another constitutional provision that says when you drive you lose the right to withdraw consent previously given?
I don't have a good answer for that, but I can say that I am certain there is not any case from this court or from the U.S. Supreme Court which has ever held that there is a constitutional right to withdraw the consent which you gave when you started the car. And the Supreme Court has dealt with this at least three times, and every time has said there is no statutory right. When this court in 1999 said that, it cited South Dakota v. Neville, a 1983 case, which said flat out, there is no constitutional right to withdraw implied consent.
But there is constitutional right to withdraw other kinds of consent, just not implied consent.
Not once you get your part of the deal, which is you get to drive on a Wisconsin road, and for that you agree that under certain circumstances, when an officer asks you if you will give a test, you are going to do that.
Counsel.
If an officer comes to my home and says, knock, 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 I'd like to search your house, and you go, sure, I got nothing to hide, come on in. And then you think, you know, perhaps that was not a good idea. Can he tell the officer he needs to?
If at that point, sure, he can do that. If he waits until the guy turns the knob, walks in and says, oh, look, drugs, he can't just say, I'll leave, and you don't get the evidence.
Right.
But and I think that's kind of what this is. At this point, there is some reason that you've been stopped, not you, but that a guy, someone has been stopped, or that he is now having a contact with the officer who is saying, now I am invoking the implied consent law. You already agreed to consent, and now I want a sample.
So we do something like a benefit of the bargain kind of analysis. You got your part of the bargain. It's a contract now. You cannot revoke the consent.
You can revoke it because we have a statutory opportunity to do that, but it doesn't come free, and you're going to lose your license.
Okay, but it's a statutory opportunity, not a statutory right.
Right.
Statutory privilege.
No.
Not a privilege.
This court said it is not a privilege.
It's just an opportunity.
Yes.
All right. I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Perlman. Is a statute constitutional if it says you've got this, You're deemed to have consented when you drive on the Wisconsin roads. You're deemed to have consented to blood tests. You're deemed to consent to urine tests. You're deemed to consent to breath test. You cannot revoke, recant, or change this consent. Is that constitutional?
I don't know for sure, but we don't have that law. So there is an opportunity.
Oh, but very limited, according to you.
I don't think so. In this case, in a 3AR case, you have two opportunities to say no.
I have a very hard time reading the statute to give you two opportunities.
I think it has to be read that way.
Well, it has to be read that way, but I don't see it in the language. The other thing is, it just strikes me that what you have here is an attempt by the legislature, which I think is really worthy.
Which is what?
Which is very worthy of trying to get access to either breath, urine, or blood so that we can curb drunk driving, which is a real menace on the road to all of us.
Yes.
Statistics are awful on that, and Wisconsin is no better than other states and maybe worse than other states. Okay. And the goal here was that that the legislature imposes consequences if you recant, revoke, change your mind on consent. And that's the way this statute is set up. And what I think the legislature or you're trying to do is make it that, hey, very difficult for someone to refuse. And you're quoting language, and you know what? That language is in our opinions. And then it's repeated from one opinion to the other without anyone ever thinking about what it really means. So what do you think of that?
I think it is hard to refuse, and that is the goal. The goal of the law is to get tests because we have a huge problem with drunk driving and drug driving. And this part of the statute, 3AR, was passed to deal with how hard this is. In lots of cases, this only comes into play with a crash where someone is dead or hurt badly. And the goal there, when it's one cop or two cops with a crash scene who have to deal with hurt people, and who's going to come and help them, and who was driving, and which cars you don't want to come onto the scene, and trying to secure the scene, and then trying to find out who did what, who was drunk. You don't have a lot of time. They were trying to make it easy. They were trying to make it that since the goal of drunk driving laws isn't just to stop people from driving drunk, it's to stop them from doing this. You don't want to crash, and you don't want deaths. So the goal, with that goal in mind, they are trying to make it easy and say, if you're in a crash and you did anything wrong, you're going to have to take a test or you're going to lose your license.
But, okay, never mind.
Counsel, I'd like to look at the issue of consent in a slightly different context, view perhaps or facet. And I'm curious about why we play around with the idea of implied consent at all. Couldn't the legislature simply write a statute that says that if you drive, you must submit upon demand to a blood test, and that if you don't, you will be punished according to these prescriptions? Couldn't they do that?
I don't know if they could, but I don't think that would pass. That would be fairly harsh. The goal is to have some kind of reason that you're going to ask for a test, and in this case, there is a big reason.
Right. So let's just take the implied consent language out of this. You're involved in an accident that causes great bodily harm or death. Couldn't the statute simply say, under those circumstances, you must submit to a test, and if you don't, we will punish you, without talking about consent at all?
It could, and we'd be here.
And would that be constitutional?
I don't know for sure, but that's not what the law says.
Oh, I know, but I'm trying to figure out the significance of this implied consent to our constitutional analysis.
I think implied consent is consent, and if it's not withdrawn, it is consent.
But we don't use In what other circumstances, as opposed to a declaratory statement, let me make it an interrogatory. In what other circumstances do we say that you have given, you've impliedly given your consent? Because normally we talk about consent in terms of knowing and voluntary, right? And that's simply out the door here. We just pretend. Are there other circumstances in which we pretend that people have given their consent to something?
There are. When you go into an airport, if you go into an army base, there are times when that does happen. But I just want to say that these laws have been upheld repeatedly forever by every state, including this state, countless times, and by the Supreme Court every time it's ever dealt with it.
I know, but if
there's not a constitutional problem with the idea of a law.
Countless repetition is not going to be very helpful when we get to the point of writing an opinion in this case. I mean, we have to be able to describe why, as a constitutional basis, this makes sense. Right?
Okay.
So in your examples of the airport or an army base, that's not implied consent. That's actual consent. You have to walk up to a place, and in order to get from point A, where you are, to point B on the other side of the metal detector, you've got to agree to be searched, right? This is not that case. When you drive, you get in your car, and your intention is to go from point A to point B, and there's no metal detector or breath test in between those points. The point of decision comes when you're arrested, and at that point, you have to make that decision. And at that point, we say, you've already given consent. So that would be similar to showing up at the airport, and you're standing on the lee side of the metal detector, and we say, well, you've already consented to be searched because you got in your car in the morning, right?
I don't know that I have a great answer, but the law has been upheld every time. There has never been anything for the court to find it constitutional. All the court has to do is cite it.
How about you can't go through the metal detector and see if they find your gun and then say, oh, by the way, I didn't really want to come here.
Sure.
That would be withdrawing the consent after the blood test is done. We're not talking about that. We're talking about before the search is done.
Well, a court has found that you can do that, which of course is wrong, but that's what has resulted from the Court of Appeals opinion in Padley. Which, of course, is wrong. If I can say one thing quickly, because I talked about how the law works and how the arrest under 3A can be for refusal or whichever traffic law you broke and not for a drunk driving offense, I think it's clear from how the law works. Sub 3A says, upon arrest of a person for a violation of 346.63, blah, 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 or upon arrest subsequent to a refusal under paragraph AR. If the arrest had to be for drunk driving, there would be no need to say, or upon arrest, subsequent to a refusal under paragraph AR.
Subsequent is not the same as for.
No, but if it was an arrest after that, and if the arrest had to be for 346.63, you wouldn't have to say that. You would just say under 346.63.
But part of what bothers me...
And they added it, but they didn't have to.
Part of what's bothering me with your argument is they can't win the refusal hearing.
In many cases, that's true.
It's like saying, I'm going to arrest you for armed robbery, but I know you don't have a gun, and you'll never be charged with that. And if you were charged with that, we would lose all day long. How would we feel about that if an officer could just decide to arrest people for things they never, ever could prove?
When they passed the law, I attached something in the brief, to the brief, which shows a alleged counsel memo that makes clear that what they were trying to do is remove that portion of the statute if it is an AR refusal, so that really all you have to show to uphold a revocation after a person refuses under AR and then A is that the officer asked for the test and the person said no.
But that's not what the statute really says. It seems to me we have another example or an example of the legislature didn't get to the next step. They should, unlike the normal refusal hearing that we
that we're used to, where the first thing to show is probable cause, right? And then I mean, refusal and probable cause. They should have amended the refusal statute to include different elements that fit into the kind of situation we have here, and they just, for whatever reason, that was not done.
May I answer?
Yes, please do.
It's not clear. In the brief, I did argue that the words, that the issues at the hearing are limited to these, could mean those are the only ones which can be raised. It doesn't have to mean all of them have to be raised at every hearing. The other option is that they failed to amend the statute. But I don't know why that would lead to a constitutional issue in this case. It is a statutory issue. He gave consent when he operated. He was told you are going to lose your license. And like any person who refuses, it's the same thing. If you request a hearing in 10 days and if you win, you won't lose your license. But if those two things don't happen, you are going to lose your license. It's not all that different.
Thank you very much.
I have a question for you. Counsel, you referred to that many states have upheld the constitutionality. Have any other states the same provision as Wisconsin has, that you can demand a test if there's a bad accident and there is a traffic violation, state or municipal?
May I answer?
Yes, please.
Yes, there are some. I don't have an exact number, but in the last couple of days, I know of about 5 out of the 10 who answered as to if they had that type of law, and about
the 5.
North Carolina, Louisiana, maybe Iowa? I'm sorry, I don't have the list with me.
Okay, maybe it may be provide
my,
it to
I may
the
have
court.
It, but I don't have it with me.
Okay. Maybe you can provide that to the court, Mr. Sanders.
If the court would like.
Thank you.
If we want it, we will advise you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your argument. Rebuttal, please. I don't know if your colleague had a chance to find the spot, because I still can't find it. Just tell me the page and don't bother with anything else.
It's page 38 of the slip opinion, Your Honor. It's not a quote, but it's mechanically how it worked.
You don't need to tell me mechanically. I'll figure that out. I just wanted to look up the quote. You say it's page 38.
38.
Okay. I got the opinion. I can do it. You didn't
answer.
I think Justice Abrahamson had a task for you that she wanted you to answer.
Well, if I could just quickly answer the court's question about the number of states that have declared similar provisions unconstitutional, I actually have the answer. It's not 5 out of 10. It's 9 out of 10. And those states are State versus Blank in Alaska, State versus Quinn in Arizona, Cooper versus State in Georgia, King versus Ryan, Illinois, State versus DeClercq, Kansas, State versus Roche, Maine, McDuff versus State, Mississippi, Commonwealth versus Cole, Pennsylvania, Hanoi versus State, Indiana.
And what do those cases say?
All of those cases stand for the proposition that their versions of this statute are unconstitutional because it eliminates any requirement of particularized suspicion. So to answer your question earlier about do you have the right to refuse, you absolutely have the constitutional right to refuse an unreasonable request by a law enforcement officer. It is patently unreasonable to ask someone to give a sample of their blood under pain of arrest or license revocation, whichever, when there's no suspicion whatsoever that the cops are going to find what they're looking for.
Well, even if there were suspicion, wouldn't you need a warrant?
Well, if you're talking about true consent, then if it's true consent, then it potentially could give the officer a basis to do that. But this is not true consent, because we keep talking about the implied consent law as if it's one way. The implied consent law is a contract between the driver and the state of Wisconsin. And the contract says, yes, you impliedly consent, but the state agrees to provide you with accurate information about your decision to submit or not. Let's not forget that the informing the accused form that is read to the person, it's not simply an advisement of rights. Two-thirds of the way down on the page is a direct question. Will you agree to submit to an evidentiary chemical test of your blood?
See, your case is notably different because the officer said there were no indicia of intoxication. There was just an accident.
Correct.
And I'm not saying that that's good. It's horrible there was an accident. But had the officer said, red eyes, slurred speech, other indicia of intoxication, things like that, then we wouldn't even be here today, right?
Well, and that's why, Your Honor, exactly, and that's why...
But you're also not arguing, are you, that implied consent means I can get in my car, go drive down the road, and I've consented until I get caught, right?
Well, again, the implied consent law cannot be used as a vehicle by itself to find consent. That's why Bailand, one of the three defendants in Birchfield, that's why his case had to be remanded back down to the trial court, because the trial court said, well, I don't care if it's constitutional or not.
Well, the statute
you consented under our implied consent law.
There's no guarantee that you get to actually get from the bar to your home. I mean, that's not what the implied consent law says. The implied consent law says the moment you get in the car and you start driving, you've impliedly consented, or you've consented to certain things, and there are penalties if you decide to refuse that consent that you once granted, right? There's no guarantee you actually get home.
True. There is no guarantee that you get home.
So there are penalties associated with implied consent that are valid, or are you arguing there are no penalties that can be associated?
No, there are. The penalties are valid for people, and this is why we take all of the other decisions, the implied consent decisions that this court has rendered over the years, with a grain of salt, because in every single one of those cases, the person was lawfully arrested for drunk driving. This court has never considered this issue. This issue involves a person involved in an accident who may have committed a traffic violation and is asked for a sample of their blood under no particularized suspicion that they're going to find alcohol or drugs in that blood sample. That is an unreasonable request, and it's this statute that provides the foundation for that unreasonableness in every case, like Mr. Blackman's. They don't have to find anything. A traffic statute plus injury equals you either consent or your license gets revoked. Now,
right,
I do.
Isn't that part of the contract that you just mentioned? This is the contract between the state and the driver. You get in your car and drive. If you get in an accident that causes great bodily harm or death, part of that contract is you submit to a blood test.
I disagree, Your Honor, and this gets back to this is why I led in with this quote when I first got up to this podium.
Make sure you're...
There is a limit, according to the Birchfield Court, of the things that people can impliedly consent to without violating the Fourth Amendment. It is an unreasonable expectation of a driver to be...
Find me that quote, because I think that's... Birchfield says there's a limit to the... to the penalties you can have.
There must be a limit to the consequences to which motorists may be deemed to have consented by virtue of a decision to drive on public.
Right. And that was in the context of the penalty, not the kinds of things you can consent to.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Your Honor, if I could just add one thing with respect to the smoking gun. I know Justice Ann Walsh Bradley had asked me about this earlier.
Very quickly.
I'll be very quick. The legislature never intended for the person to be arrested for refusing the test, as Mr. Sanders has been arguing. That's why it references 3A. The legislative council memo from 2005 says precisely this. If the person refuses an AR2 test, they may be arrested for OWI based on nothing more than a refusal to submit to a test that was grounded on nothing. That's the problem.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you both for very spirited arguments. We've had a lot of
cases that involve informed consent this term. We keep thinking we're going to smooth all the sharp edges off, but then you all figure out some other ones to bring to us. So thank you very much. We are going to adjourn for the lunch break. We'll be back at 1:30 for our third case of the day. The students who can remain should do so. Justice Ziegler will be with you shortly. We are adjourned.